I love Lord of the Rings, and I wanted to read something else exactly like it. And that's how I came across the Space Trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet.
Welcome to the first of a special two-part episode of All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com, and I had the pleasure of moderating the keynote speaker panel at the C.S. Lewis and Inkling Studies Conference held at the end of March 2015 at Grove City College. The speakers were Dr. Jerry Root and Dr. Diana Glyer. They fielded about a dozen questions submitted by conference participants. In this show, you will hear them answer six questions, and next week I will post the remaining answers. Of course, if you are catching this later than the initial posting, then the second part might already be available. You can stop by EssentialCSLewis.com to see what the latest show is, or at allaboutjack.podbean.com. There you can also see the show notes for this edition and see a list of questions along with links to anything mentioned during the interchange between Jerry and Diana. A couple of the questions addressed today are Joy's influence on Till We Have Faces and why Jerry recommends Dimer, a poetry book from Lewis written before he was a Christian.
I have several questions up here. The first one here, this individual might think that you may have, you're old enough to have met Lewis, but I could be misreading the question. So they may not necessarily think anyway, Lewis died 50 years ago, you know. And, all right, we know you guys are all just 48, I think.
That's good.
All right, the first question is, could you tell us about your first encounter with Jack or his writing? How old were you? What were your impressions? How do you recall it fondly?
Well, I tell this story at the introduction of the company they keep, that when I was in high school, I was part of an honors group, and we all kind of traveled together as a posse, the same 40 students in all the same classes. Some of you may have that in your high school experience. And within my group, The Lord of the Rings became wildly popular. It became so popular that all the cool kids were reading it, and all the cool kids started giving each other names based on the characters. So you'd have a conversation, and someone would say, "Hey, over the weekend, you know, Gandalf got together with Bilbo and went bowling." And they would do this on and on, and I felt like an outsider because I didn't know what they were talking about. Well, to make it even worse, they started to call me Galadriel. And I didn't know what that meant either. Is that a good thing? Okay. So in self-defense, I read the book. Now, the first time I read The Lord of the Rings, I couldn't tell the characters apart because I was very shy. That was back in the days before we had Peter Jackson to help us. And I didn't know how to pronounce any of the names. I was very intimidated by the names. And so when I would read it, I would read like, and then the G guy would say this, and the B guy went to the M place, you know, because I didn't know how. But then I got them all confused, and I couldn't tell an elf from a dwarf, which is really a problem. So I had to make a color-coded chart of elves on one sheet of paper, and dwarves, and men, and hobbits. And once I got it all straight, I fell in love with the story. I love Lord of the Rings, and I wanted to read something else exactly like it. And there wasn't a whole lot else back then that one could read. And that's how I came across the Space Trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, and realized that while superficially it was as different can be, there was an underlying unity, a desire to capture something of significant spiritual truth in the guise of a story that was just relentlessly interesting. And that's how I first came across the work of C.S. Lewis and became interested then, soon after, in the fact that my two favorite authors were friends.
I didn't become a Christian until I was a freshman in college. I had no academic interest when I went to college. You have to take this completely by faith now, but I was an athlete then. And I went to college to play sports. And
what sport?
I was a football player and a wrestler. And I coached college football for 10 years as well. But anyway, what happened is I became a Christian and I was very intrigued. And I thought everybody would want to know they're loved by God and they're forgiven. So I wanted to tell everybody about this great good news. Great green dragon, I heard. And my friends asked questions I never once thought about asking. I never asked about problem of evil things or how come Christians say they're the only way and how what about other religions and so on. So I was digging for answers because I thought my friends would want to know the answers, and if I could help them, if that was a barrier, that would be great. And I saw this name crop up in the literature, C.S. Lewis. But I still didn't bother to read him. My older sister was teaching fifth grade, and she was reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to her students. She told me the plot of that book over dinner one night, and I thought, wow, there's books like this out there. So I read the Narnian books, and then I wanted to find out about the guy who wrote them, and I found out he had an autobiography. I read Surprised by Joy, and he talked about the deep longings and the quest to find the object of those longings. I knew the longings. And he, in a sense, gave me a vocabulary for my soul. So I just started reading everything I could get my hands on. And when I graduated from college, a man wisely told me, you do not get an education in college. All you do is lay a foundation for an education. And commencement, the graduation exercises, say that you are now going to commence your education by building on that foundation. Pick an author who will take you places and make that author your life study. Well, I don't think it has to be an author. It could be a composer. It could be a period of history. It could be an artist, a country, whatever. But something that keeps you engaged and growing and connects you with other things. So I picked Lewis. I go to seminary, and that was a surprise to me, too, to go to seminary, because they let so many students, a few students in every year on probation, and I took the whole quota the year that I went there. And I knew I had to write a master's thesis, and there's no way I was going to write it on the use of the optative mood in the Greek text of Philemon. It wasn't going to hold me. But I could write it on Lewis, and so I wrote on Lewis. That took me deeper, and then later the other, and so that's kind of how it started.
Let's see. I'll go next with, here's one for also both, essentially, although it would at any time, if you both have comments. What daily habit would you recommend to a student who is growing in their appreciation of literature and the literary arts?
One piece of advice in terms of daily habits is if you hang around with writers much at all, you notice that writers always have little notebooks with them. I would say that if you want to develop the habit of as a literary critic, you need to be developing or cultivating the key to all good reading, which is to pay attention. And the best tool to learn to pay attention is start carrying a little notebook with you. I carry a little moleskin journal with me everywhere I go. It was changed my life when I went away, when I stopped having like a prayer journal and a place where I put my sermon notes and a little scrapbook. And you know how you have all those little journals and notebooks? And then you can never find the one you need when you're at the place where... I stopped all that and I have one little moleskin notebook and I carry it everywhere. And I doodle in it and I take notes in it and I take sermon notes in it and I write my morning prayers in it when I do devotions. And I also reflect on the things that I'm reading. And I take it seriously that perhaps my thoughts on the text matter. And that's a really important skill to cultivate. Your thoughts on the text, they matter. What happens when you read a text as a unique individual, a unique lens, encountering that text? You need to record those things. What a notebook does, it's not for reference. I used to think that this was something that after the fact would, you know, mean something or I'd look back into it. I hardly ever look back into it, but what a pen and a notebook teaches me to do is to learn to pay attention, to notice things, to notice that felicitous phrase that someone like a Jerry Root just says off the cuff. But then I capture it, and I hold it, and I ponder it, right? And the reason that I catch it in the first place is because my notebook teaches me to pay attention.
If I was thinking about this question, I would ask, what kind of literary life do you want to live? And I would hope everybody would be hungry to live a literary life, even if you're not a professional literary person or academic. God made us in His image. He made us as reasonable people, rational people. He made us as people with hearts, C.S. Lewis said that he felt the first problem in life is how do you connect the head and the heart. So hopefully your literary life will help you to do that. But I would suggest to you, if you're a non-professional, whenever you pick up a book, if it doesn't capture you right away, don't read it. But don't prejudice yourself against it. It might be the very book you need 5 years from now. But stay engaged and learn to love literature. And if you're a professional literary person, make sure you never lose that love. I've seen too many academics who their academic life has become all-consuming. It's their job, and their heart for literature has grown cold. Even if you're an academic, I would say keep books going besides your professional work, and keep on the stretch, and get to the place where it takes your breath away. I'm totally surprised that I'm here, to be honest with you, because I just started reading Lewis and writing stuff on Lewis and so on because I was intrigued. I was fascinated by it. And one day I woke up and all of a sudden I'm going everywhere lecturing on Lewis. And I thought to myself one time, I feel like a boy, a person who when he was a boy saw a little beetle on a leaf in the back garden of his house. And he was first captured by the sheen of the light reflected on the wings. And he went to the library and got books to find out if he could identify the beetle. And then he started studying the habitat and the life cycle and all the other things about this beetle, and then woke up one day and everybody wanted to know about the beetle. C.S. Lewis is my beetle. And if you weren't interested, I'd still be in. And that's what you want to do. You want to be a person who's still in, whether anybody else wants to know it about it or not, because your whole life is qualitatively better because you engaged in these kinds of studies that captured your heart and mind and soul.
If I could say just one more thing, I can't help reflecting on how C.S. Lewis might answer the question. What might his advice be? And one of the things he advises is that we reread books that we've read already. Because the first time through, we're discovering along the way. The second time through, when we know how the story ends, we read the beginning very differently from the way that we do, not knowing where we're going. So don't be afraid to read and reread and reread the books. You'll change, and the book will seem to change too. You'll see layers. If it's a worthy book, then 20, 30, and 40 times down the road, you're still going to be discovering brand new things. One of the reasons I know that the Chronicles of Narnia are magnificent is every time I try to study them, I fall into them, and I look up an hour later, and I can't figure out why I'm there. The second thing he would say is in the introduction to his to Athanasius, he's got a lovely little essay on that book. And he encourages the habit of reading one old book for every new book that you read. And it can be challenging, the old books, the old classics. But it's really worth it to think about our varied diet as readers and to make sure that we're reading things that might be outside of our regular range. So Lewis would say read one old book for every new.
All right, can I say one more thing?
I don't know.
He's in Experiment and Criticism and in of Other Worlds.
Experiment and Criticism is a great book.
It is an important book.
Great book.
And it's not very long.
No, it's really short.
Yeah. But in Experiment and Criticism and in Of Other Worlds, he says, the mark of a literary person is that they read a book more than once. Yeah. Don't beat yourself up. Come to the Wade Center at Wheaton College. We'll go down into the stacks. We have his library there. We'll pull out his copy of Don Juan by Lord Byron. In the back cover, he has his name. He has the date he finished the book. And he has right underneath it, never again. And he describes that book, actually, in Surprised by Joy as well. But you can see it. They have the green book, even, that he marked up when he was writing Abolition Man and all that stuff. But anyway, so Lewis thought some books weren't worth reading more than once, and some certainly aren't worth reading even once. But what does he mean? What does he mean? The mark of the literary person is they read a book more than once. And as Diana just said, you can go deeper and deeper with the book. And not only that, every time you come to the book, you're a little bit different person. So you're going to get more out of it every time. But there's another reason why he said that. He said, we fall in love with the world of the book, whether it be an elegantly crafted argument like Mere Christianity or The Abolition of Man, or it be a story like Till We Have Faces or Perlandra. And he said, we tend to fall in love with the world created in that book. And it awakens us and touches us at the place where we long for that world. And it touches us at the place where we long for the only other world we could ever really know, which is heaven. And so it's a very spiritual exercise as well. So I think that's important.
I'll just briefly add, regarding an experiment in criticism, my background is not from the literary background, and I very much enjoyed that book. Of course, the fact that it was short is also good as well, but anyway. And then the preface to...
Athanasius.
Yes, yes. Anyway, that is also an essay on the reading of old books, I believe. And it's in God and the Dog. Okay, yes. So just for you keeping track or wanting to know here. But the next one here is, of the seven in the Wade, it seems that Owen Barfield is one of the least read and least discussed. For those who have not yet read any of his works, with which works should we start?
You want me to, I mean, you're the one that's Inkling's expert, but I would say Saving the Appearances.
Really?
That's where I would start. I would start with Saving the Appearances.
You could. I would start with Poetic Diction. Tell me why.
All right, duke it out.
Well, the reason why I got to it was because Lewis talks about Saving the Appearances and Discarded Image. I wanted to read then what Barfield had to say about Saving the Appearances, but I thought it was an elegantly written book.
It is.
It's accessible. Some of Barfield's thoughts are not very accessible. I thought that book was very accessible. And so, anyway, if you can find one that's accessible, but Diana will tell you the one you ought to read because she's read them all and I haven't.
I think that it is problematic to claim that any sentence that Owen Barfield ever wrote is accessible. I just don't think, unless you have a capacious, amazing, blazing intellect,
that
such as yourself. That's the only explanation. Owen Barfield is difficult. He's a philosopher, and he's looking at the relationship between language and meaning. And he's always exploring similar questions. But I think Poetic Diction is interesting to me because it is his earlier work and because Lewis had so much participation in it. And so I think that it's an interesting artifact as an illustration of their collaboration and their conversation, which suggests another work that you might want to look at that's just been published, which is his what they call the Great War. They took this idea of iron sharpening iron very seriously, and they wrote each other a series of letters. Although that's not really a good description of them. They sent them as letters, but what they really are philosophical essays, as they tried to hammer out some of the differences between them. And these letters are worth studying for what it looks like to have a thoughtful, compassionate argument at the highest possible level. These have just been published for the first time by the Inkling's Journal, isn't that right? Isn't that where that appears? And I've just gotten my copy. It's very exciting to have, again, the primary conversation between these two early on. Many people have argued that C.S. Lewis honed his ability to craft a careful argument in the course of these letters with his friend. So this is really important for his early thought, but also his early practice of learning how to articulate what he believed and why he believed it. So it's the Great War letters, and they've just been published, and I commend them to you.
The other thing, too, is that Lewis said that Arthur Greaves was his first friend. They read the same books, and they read them and got the same things out of them and agreed. Barfield was his second friend, and he said they read the same books, and Barfield got all the wrong things out of them. And he says everybody needs that second friend. Diana's been talking to us about this all weekend. And I think that that's also intriguing that Barfield will give you an introduction to that kind of exchange, as you just said. But another example of it is the book that Lewis wrote called The Personal Heresy with E.M.W. Tilliard. and they disagreed over how to interpret Milton, and the exchange started in a literary journal called Essays and Studies at Oxford University, and they continued on in a book, and you can't find one ad hominem in that book. You don't have people calling each other names. You don't have them being dismissive. You have them taking each other seriously. And both men you can see growing through the exchange. And that's a great model, too.
It's a wonderful model.
Okay. Different direction here. Question is, would you tell us more about why you recommend Dimer, which I think was Jerry, and any thoughts on Spirits and Bondage?
Well, Spirits and Bondage was the first book that Lewis wrote. It came out in 1919. He was working on it before he went to war, came out just after he went to war. He was actually considered one of the war poets early on, with Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon and so on. Of course, he was not in any way of that ilk. But there are some of the poems that have some war connection, though Lewis was only in the trenches for about 3.5 months, the way I figure it. He arrived in the trenches November 29th, his birthday, 1917. He's wounded April 15th, 1918, but he had trench fever and he was out of the trenches for about a month, month and a half. So he's only in the trenches for about 3.5 months, but he writes some of these poems that way. But he has one line in there, and there's stuff about that homeless longing vexes me. You get some hints in it of where Lewis is going with this longing. But other than that, I just think it's maybe a great way to look at how far an author can grow over a lifetime. You at least see a starting point. But Dimer, on the other hand, Dimer is a man who's living in this city, and it was a city built upon the concept of Plato's Republic. And Lewis said it's an indoctrination city, it's a tyranny, really. And Lewis is writing at a time when the world was hell-bent after what was going on in Russia, what was beginning to emerge in Italy and Germany. And Lewis says of the city that those who built it tortured into stone the bubbles the academy had blown. And it's rigid, and you need reality as iconoclastic. He's sitting in an indoctrinational hall, and he's being lectured and told what to believe, and Dimer looks out the window. And Lewis says, who could ever legislate spring? The real world was more than this artificial world. He bolts from the city and has these adventures. It's a quest story. And you see him when he writes Pilgrim's Regress. You've also got a quest thing, but in Pilgrim's Regress, he puts the answers and he's become a Christian. But in Dimer, you'll find all the questions. And it's a great, great book.
I wouldn't speak to Dimer particularly, but to Lewis's poetry more broadly. And I think it's really important that we get to know Lewis, the poet. I think it's incredibly important because the heartbeat of his literary life is in his poems. All his life long, he's a poet. His early ambition is to become a great poet. And while he transfers that ambition to a much grander ambition of serving God, still this creation of poetry and this expressing the insights and the beauties of everyday life in poetry is something that is a heartbeat throughout his entire life. And we need to recognize this. This is close to his heart. And I think that looking at his poetry, spending more time with his poetry is really important.
All right, this is somewhat similar to a previous question, but there is enough differences to, I want to address it. It's noted specifically to you, Jerry, but you can also comment, of course, Diana. You seem to keep track of how many times you've read various books. Would you suggest a reading schedule for a young scholar, both an ideal schedule and a practical one?
I'm going to immediately pass that one.
No.
Well, okay.
Again, if you're not under the gun of somebody, follow the inclination of your heart.
Amen.
I don't think you have to worry about it. And I'm always going back and rereading Lewis, but that's not all I read. I've got other authors I trace. I got into Evelyn Underhill through Lewis, and if I would have found her maybe before Lewis, I would have made her my life's author. She opened up a million doors on the medieval mystics, and I've read all those. But again, that's following the branch off of Lewis onto this branch, onto this twig and tributary, and so on. But But also, I've always got a Lewis book or two that I'm rereading, always. And not because I feel I need to, but because I just got to get back there and reconnect. And as Diana said a moment ago, I can go deeper every read. So I don't think you have to be rigid unless you're doing academic work. I mean, if you're going to do a doctorate, you better start the 600 books you need to read now.
If you're going to do good primary research, yeah. Right? Absolutely. I think if you ask practically anybody in this room, you'd say all of us have a little stack by our bed, right? Our bedstands have no room for the coffee cup. Because there are 5, 6, 8, 20. I have to get down the end of my bed to get off of it because the pile of books has gotten onto the floor, and right? So we're all reading a lot of things at the same time. And maybe that would be the advice that I would give, not so much a reading regimen, but even in the course of a day or a week, the rhythms of what I'm interested in, what I'm able to read, whether I need something more relaxing or something more challenging. I'm not always ready for the challenging book, you know? So you kind of keep a number of things that are in motion, that are that you're constantly reading all the time. And I wanted to ask, what are you reading these days besides Lewis?
You know, this is crazy, but I'm reading Boys in the Boat. Have any of you read that one? It's an interesting novel, and I don't read novels very often, but I mean, I do read novels, but I'm reading that. I'm also going back through Allegory of Love. I have spent the last, preparing for this, last maybe 3 months reading and rereading and note-taking in Dimer. I'm not Dimer, the Discarded Image. And then trying to read a lot of Lewis's other medieval works. And then I found out somebody wrote a book. I actually bought a copy, and they basically stole all my talks before I got it. I didn't even know that book existed, but it's out there. I mean, that's the thing. You can never say nobody's ever written a book on this because it's out there somewhere. How about you? What are you reading?
I'm actually in the middle of Jan Caron's recent Mitford novel, because that's what I read for fun. And I've been reading Eugene Peterson, the one with the horse in it. I can't remember the title of it, but I find Eugene Peterson and Richard Rohr, two of the authors I go back to again and again for spiritual nourishment and spiritual encouragement. I'm reading a lot of Dante and Dante criticism right now because I'm getting ready, kind of ramping up for a sabbatical where I will be writing a book on Dante.
Wow.
So I'm getting ready for that as well. So there's just a lot of things going on reading-wise, always carrying a book with me, right?
Yeah.
Always having a stack of different things that are in progress.
Someone in the back wanted to know what book that was that you found and got. Do you care to disclose it?
The medieval one.
Which one?
The medieval
I don't know what the title was.
I
Lewis Medieval something.
Yeah, it was something on C.S. Lewis, and it was. I didn't realize. I just looked at it, picked it up, and said, "I want this book." And then it was like $57. I think I would have thought twice about it if I'd have seen the price before I bought it. But I took it back to the room, and I was looking through it, and it's worth its weight in gold.
So you can ask the bookseller at Ate Books, and he'll be able to tell you that.
Briefly for me here, regarding Lewis, one of the things I think is sadly neglected is his essays. Mm-hmm. There is out of print essentially all of them collected. However, there is an audio version that is out that is from that book, and you can get it for a very reasonable cost as opposed to sometimes out of print books.
That medieval book was Kent State University Press. I do know that. I just don't remember.
They're a good publisher.
It's a really good, they have a great taste in the book for sure.
Tell us about that.
No.
They rejected me.
Yeah. All right, Diana, you mentioned the collaboration of C.S. Lewis and Joy Davidman on Till We Have Faces. Where do we see Joy's influence and our contributions in this book?
One of the things that I argue for really strongly in Company They Keep is that when we look at influence, it's not okay for us to look at the final product and look for the ideas of one contributor or another contributor. That's not an adequate way to measure influence. When we look at influence, we need to think about influence much larger. We need to ask ourselves, how has the trajectory of this project been changed by a variety of different kinds of input? So we think about encouragement. We think about discouragement. We think about correction. We think about editing, which is actually changing aspects of it. And I also add the category of referent, places where within the text you're actually referring to either an individual or an individual's thoughts. All of these are forms of influence. And Joy Davidman's influence on Till We Have Faces was primarily in the composing process. So what's really fascinating about Till We Have, there's so many things that are fascinating about Till We Have Faces. And I really want to give a shout out to Andrew Lazo, who's working on some really outstanding ways of reading and understanding that book. I can't wait for his book to be written and published. So keep an eye out for that, Andrew Lazo. It's going to really help us a lot in terms of our appreciation of that. But here's the thing. Lewis gets the idea for writing on the Cupid and Psyche myth very early in his life. He tries to write it as a poem, and it just peters out. He tries to write it as a play, and he doesn't get anywhere with it. And so this is something that he abandons very early in his creative life. Well, Lewis makes the switch, as you know, from teaching at Oxford to teaching at Cambridge. And there are lots of advantages of that switch. His workload drops dramatically because the workload of a professor is much different from the workload of a don. And it's very, very interesting. When his workload is not relentless, when he does not have stacks of papers to grade and stacks of lectures to prepare and a room full of students to tutor, you know what happens to him? He gets writer's block for the first time in his life. Isn't that interesting? Those of us who long for a sabbatical so we can sit around and think the great thoughts, right? Lewis got stuck, and he didn't know what to do, so he sits down with Joy Davidman, and he confesses to her that he doesn't know what to write next. And so she says, well, Jack, what are you thinking about? And he tells her about this idea that he has to write about Cupid and Psyche. She's the one who suggests that he might write it as a novel. And that's the beginning of Till We Have Faces. If the reports are correct, that very night, that conversation, Joy Davidman goes off to bed, and Lewis sits down and writes the first chapter of Till We Have Faces. And then Joy reads it the next morning and gives him some feedback on what he has written. And together they converse about what he might write next and so forth through chapter after chapter of that book. So when we look at the process, she was a muse to him in the process of writing. And to me, that's more important than any content that she might have contributed. Lewis always had the idea to write it from a female point of view. She didn't contribute that aspect. But I do imagine that she contributed that sense of authenticity for that voice, don't you think? That in checking and rechecking, she could have said, this doesn't ring true. The emotions here, perhaps, are not exactly right and may have helped him just in terms of coming across with that authentic voice in that great book.
There's a woman named Kath Filmer. She wrote a book called The Mask in the Mirror, I think that's the one. And there's another one, The Sword Between the Sexes. And these have been written on Lewis as from a feminist point of view. And these authors are sympathetic towards Lewis. They're not trashing him. But they kind of hold his feet to the fire on a man writing from a woman's perspective. But I'd like to ask Diana or any of you women who are here, if you think he did a fair job with Orule, and if you think he did, then my guess is there would be evidence of Joy's influence. But any of you women thinking about doing a doctorate on Lewis, it would be interesting for you to go and look at the comparison between Jane Studdock in That Hideous Strength and Orule in Till We Have Faces and begin to study the differences of the two voices. Or maybe you could even throw in a midway, which could be Lucy in the Narnian books, and to see what kind of study, where that would take you. But I think Joy would come through in that kind of study.
Yeah, that's great. I agree.
You've been listening to the first of a two-part episode from a panel discussion with Dr. Jerry Root and Dr. Diana Glier. This was recorded when they were at Grove City College for the 2015 C.S. Lewis and Inkling Studies Conference held at the end of March. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com, and I hope you will catch the second program available a week after this episode was posted. Consider checking out my most recent shows that also relate to that conference, an exclusive interview with Dr. Jerry Root about his forthcoming book, The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis, and a short paper I read during the event entitled Not Quite Lewis, Questionable Lewisian Quotations. If you've enjoyed this show, consider sharing it with others. They typically involve interviews with authors of books related to C.S. Lewis. Stop by EssentialCSLewis.com to do that, or you can go where the audio files are hosted at allaboutjack.podbean.com. If you have questions or comments, you can email them to info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that's info@EssentialCSLewis.com.